John Andrews, good to see you, mate.
Yeah, good to see you as well.
CEO of the Institute for Race Relations. So this is a guy who's been running, well, it's the most important think tank in South Africa. Huh?
We like to think so.
How many years, how old is it now?
It's 96 years, no. Held in 1929.
Have you got a 100-year celebration?
That's in preparation already, yes. That's still 4 years off, but yes.
Okay, so we're here at ARC. Rob Herzog yesterday told us that ARC is about the right-wingers. I hope you're not a right-wing. Oh, sorry, I mustn't say that. Are you a right-wing?
No, I'm not. But I think you raised one of the questions, which is the difference between conservatives and liberals and right-wingers and how these various expressions shade into one another, which is not necessarily straightforward.
So I wasn't trying to catch you up or anything, but my view was that as a think tank, you've got to be balanced. You've got to look at all sides of the picture. And hence, that was why I said, I hope you're not a right-winger from that perspective. Have you found that there's been stuff here that has informed your opinion?
Very much so, yes. So I think that there's been a tension, I think, between conservatism and liberalism for a while in the world and also in South Africa. And I think that this conference, there were quite a lot of contributions that highlighted some of the points of difference of opinion or different views between these two schools of thought. And for me, it's really been very stimulating to hear some great thinkers express their thoughts on these notions and try to engage with what it means for us in South Africa.
Yeah, and boy, that's what we're actually going to get into now. So, John, you stay here. I'm going to go behind the camera. I'll be asking you questions from there. We can get a nice close-up of your face and then people can see. You know, they can catch your body language and,
very good.
And all the stuff like that. Maybe let's just start off with that first part of it. The people that you've heard here mm-hmm. who've really impressed you. Can you give us some thoughts on that, on who they are?
Yeah, there's almost too many to mention. And I know that Jordan Peterson was one of the great originators of this conference. And he's, you know, a very prominent intellectual.
Who is he? Just Jordan Peterson. Tell us a bit more about it.
Jordan Peterson is a Canadian psychologist, a university professor, who really came to prominence over his public statements in support of common sense values, I suppose you could say. And also, I think, for his battle with the question of religion and religiosity. So he's a little bit coy, I think, about his own faith. But certainly is very much drawn to the notion of spirituality, of religion, and specifically Christianity.
You hear a lot of that here, which has been, for me, most unusual. That I love to hear more about the spirit because it kind of weaves into everything we do. And they're unashamed about it here.
Yeah, Hawk. I think that there's also a bit of a mix of people here. So some people are more religious than others. And this is, for me, been one of the concerns, which is that this is one of the areas of conflict between conservatism and liberalism, where I think that conservatism is very much rooted in one place and one time and one culture that it's trying to conserve, whereas liberalism tries to be universal in its aspirations. It tries to identify truths that work anywhere in the world. And you might have heard in one of the earlier sessions, the speaker asking into the audience, are there any Indians in the audience? And there were none.
Not a single Indian.
Yes.
Out of 4,000 people.
Exactly. And that's still quite eye-opening. And I think if there were any criticisms of this conference, one of them would be that it has been quite parochial in the sense that it is very much focused on the West, as it is commonly understood. That's, I think, also understandable because that is the focus of the conference. And also because if you interpret culture as a technology, as a way of achieving certain ends, then what has been described here as Western culture has been a very successful technology. It is what has driven the great enrichment of the world, you can say, the lifting out of poverty of millions, the prevalence of things like the primacy of the individual, the importance of free speech, the importance of rule of law. All of these notions come out of this development, and I think it is right to highlight them and to emphasize them.
So let's talk about South Africa. As we speak here, we're getting information coming back from home to tell us that the budget has been postponed, cancelled, whatever. It's not going ahead. The ANC wanted to put a 2% VAT increase. The DA, thank goodness, has actually dug in its heels at last. It didn't do anything on Bella or not much.
Yeah.
Didn't do much on EWC. But this time round, perhaps, is this a case of maybe so far no more?
Quite possibly. And it is If this development plays out the way we think it will play out, then it will be, I think, very helpful for the health of the DA, for the health of the GNU, but ultimately also for the health of the country. Because it's not good for the country to have the ANC worldview to remain in place uncontested, which is effectively what we've mostly seen during this period of the GNU, which is that the ANC has continued governing the way it had before, with very little impact visible from the DA. Its ideas haven't really found their way into that government. And so hopefully this is now changing, illustrating a change of direction.
It also feels, being here at ARC, there's a lot of talk about renewal, about we taking our world back. We are coming back into the spotlight. And yet in South Africa, and I saw this in Davos as well, South Africa is on a different path. And up until today, it was almost like the ANC was just carrying on as it did before when it had 50% majority. Do you think there's much we can learn from what's going on here? In other words, i.e. the rest of the world, which we can take home.
Very much so. And I think what we're experiencing here at ARC is really maybe a fulcrum moment in history. It's one of those moments when history changes and is set on a different course. And that's what makes it so interesting. Because it is so new, it's hard to say what exactly is going to happen and where it's leading. But you can already intuit that there's a big change coming. And one of the things I see happening here is that I think we have been living in an age of self-delusion and self-indulgence in a certain way, where we've come to hold certain beliefs that we were able to afford because of the state of the world as it has been for the past 20, 30 years, but which we are no longer able to afford. And one of these examples would be the importance of hard power in international relations. Now, we've come out of an era when consensus politics was the order of the day. International partnerships and relationships were premised on the idea of negotiation rather than violent conflict. And that is now being changed because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because of the war in Israel and Gaza, and also because of Trump's confrontational style. I think we're entering a new order now where confrontation is going to be on the menu instead of consensus, which comes with great risks because, as Eric Weinstein said in his presentation, he thinks the risk of kinetic war is now real and becoming greater. And I think that is true.
John, I'm going to get this a little bit smaller so I can come and join you in the picture, because I really want to pick up with you now on that whole story about Eric Weinstein. Now, I have friends who are, a friend who's a big Eric Weinstein fan, and I hadn't been exposed to him until this morning. Must admit, I didn't quite follow what he was saying, but you know the guy well, and he's a rock star for conservatives anyway.
He's a huge rock star, and I probably haven't followed him as closely as I should have. But what I do appreciate about him is that he's able to break the framework in his comments and his analysis. He's able to see things from a perspective that most people don't see. And that is something very special. You know, we saw it as well with the debate on AI, where the speaker, I think, said that AI hasn't really shown us that that AI is going to soon achieve artificial general intelligence. What it has shown us is that human general intelligence is actually not as advanced as we think. Most human thinking is actually not very innovative and sophisticated. And that's the reason why AI is able to emulate it so easily and is so easily able to pass the Turing test. And that's the kind of insight that you don't really get very often from reading normal media, normal stories. But that's the kind of insight you get from Eric Weinstein.
Yeah, you kind of got to be here to feel it, to feel the energy. And there was a lot of energy in that room. And so we're now up to the... Well, so we're in that kind of last lap, the final half of a three-day conference, and you can still feel that energy.
It's yes.
A lot going on, a lot of buzz. Are you still in that zone yourself?
Yes. I think it depends a bit on the speaker, but I did find it noteworthy that in some of the presentations, how attentive the audience was, that you'd sort of see them responding immediately to a comment that they resonated with, and sort of small waves of applause coming up and sort of this interaction being really strong, which is amazing considering that it's a huge hall. You know, it's a sort of a tiered arena.
Yeah.
XL, 4,000 people there. The stage is far away. You can't really, you know, interact with the person. But the people are so following so closely what is being said and really responding to it. That's quite impressive.
Okay, so let's go home again. Let's go to our business community. And what, if you were putting a presentation together for your team,
mm-hmm.
what would be your big takeaway hear that the people at the island are need to know, must know.
So my big takeaway really would be that we're exiting an age of self-delusion and self-indulgence.
What does that mean?
It means that we are, I think that we have been telling lies to ourselves in South Africa for a
while. We've been, to put it coarsely, bullshitting ourselves.
Yeah. And one of our bullshits, I think, has been that we are, we think that there are shortcuts, you know, so that you can achieve economic growth through redistribution, or you can uplift everybody on the basis of race-based policies. And what we're discovering is it doesn't work, and it has not produced the results that we want. And my sense is that the rest of the world is emerging from the self-delusion and is taking a hard look at reality and changing how it interacts with reality and what sort of policies it chooses. And I think South Africa is going to be a few years behind that development, because currently we're still holding onto our delusions. We're still being self-indulgent despite the cost, which is becoming visible.
How long have we been going backwards? The GDP per capita. In other words, the value of the economy for each person who lives in South Africa. How long has that been going backwards?
Well, we typically say that there's a breaking point around 2008. And I'm not sure if it's true for GDP per capita per se. That might have still continued rising for, you know, a couple of years after 2008. But since then, it certainly declined. And that, of course, was the year of the great financial crisis, the global financial crisis, when other countries also experienced declines in GDP per capita. But other countries came out of it again, and they started increasing their, you know, employment, their GDP per capita, which South Africa didn't do. We failed to sort of come out of that. The same with COVID. The rest of the world comes out of it, you know, gets back into a bit of growth and creating jobs.
Keeps going now.
And we keep going down, or we stagnate. And that's 2008, more or less, is since when we've been going wrong.
There are a couple of things I want to throw at you. The one that came to me very strongly was that the Brits were really angry. Nigel Farage has had a conversation here, and he's now the leader of the most popular political party in the UK. Surprise, surprise. And he was saying, we're putting all of these regulations into our system so that we cannot be competitive anymore.
Yes.
So we're getting rid of our steel plants.
Yes.
And the steel will then get made in China, dirty steel, because we want to be the cleanest in the world, this virtue signaling.
Yep.
And we then import it back to South Africa. Yep. We've got a situation right now in South Africa where we're doing that. We've got BEE, which makes it expensive. We've got minimum wage. We've got a whole raft of things that make us uncompetitive, and now ArcelorMittal about to close down the steel plants. Surely there's a wake-up call there somewhere. How do we take this knowledge and, hey, guys?
Well, so I think there's a wave of deregulation spreading through the world. In Argentina with Javier Milei, in the United States with Donald Trump, probably also in Canada with Pierre Poilievre, if he gets elected as the next Prime Minister of Canada, and in some other countries as well, India and Vietnam, for example. If we follow that example, then we will be successful. You know, so I think the countries that deregulate and that pursue economic growth with as a high priority will succeed in that. It's our choice whether we do that or not. And I do think we've got a bit of a competitive advantage compared to Europe, for example, because we are not as heavily regulated as Europe. And one example is that on the flight here, I was sitting next to an engineer who told me that in his engineering company, the use of ladders is forbidden. So if you're an office worker in this engineering company, you have to change a light bulb. You're not allowed to use a ladder to do so because it's much too dangerous. You're also not allowed to get up
and you're going crazy.
Yes, you need like special equipment and sort of platforms that come in and elevate a person to change a light bulb. This is very expensive. And that is a competitive advantage for South Africa because you can say we're allowed to use a ladder. We can get a lot of stuff done a lot quicker, a lot more easily, a lot more cheaply than countries like the UK and also the Europe, which are very highly regulated.
So we've got advantages.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But at the moment, we are not playing to our advantages. In fact, we're putting disadvantages in the way.
Yes.
Like they were talking here about the net zero story.
Yeah.
Help us through that. People in South Africa know that we've got a government that has been borrowing a lot of money and that the Europeans are giving us money so that we can reduce our carbon emissions. And what I heard here was that Britain, for instance, has 1% of the world's carbon emissions. China's got 40%. China has got a lot longer to get rid of its carbon emissions on the deal than Britain does. Britain, say, halves it from 1% to 0.5%.
Yeah.
China's going up by 1% or whatever a year. So they're saying here, hey, bad deal, bad deal. We in South Africa are doing the same thing. It's
yes.
Anyway, we close our coal-fired power stations when we've got 200 years of coal.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think what gets a bit lost in the net zero discussion is the question of trade-offs. And this pursuit of net zero has been done without calculating the costs of it. And what several speakers here have emphasized is that the transition to renewables increases energy costs very dramatically and makes economies less competitive, like the German economy, like the British economy, for example. South Africa, I think, is still following the European model of trying to transition out
again,
of fossil. Yeah.
Like we did with labor legislation.
Yes. And I think we should be actually focusing on the American, Argentinian, and probably in the future Canadian model of saying, you know, cheap energy drives economic growth. You've got to have cheap energy. You've got to pursue that. You've got to get the economy growing. And the case for us is even stronger than it is for the UK and other jurisdictions, because poverty is far higher. You know, we need to make South Africans wealthier, and we need to use cheap energy to do that.
So what about jobs? And there really is a potential for a lot more jobs. So I'm going back now on the other side. We'll get a nice close-up with you while we close off our conversation here. It's been such a joy to have someone like John to take us through the big stories, because these are big things, John. These are really, it's like we're on a cusp.
Yes.
And if we go in the correct direction, which we don't tend to do too often in South Africa, sadly, but if we were to take that choice, we could really unleash enormous prosperity within the country for everyone. Lots of jobs, lots of prosperity. It seems to be a choice.
Exactly. And maybe this is a good time for me to mention the IRR's current campaign, which is called What SA Can Be. And what we are proposing to South Africans and to the government is that we have the choice of what sort of a country we are, what sort of a country we want to become. And the vision of South Africa is one where there's lots of jobs, rising incomes, infrastructure that works, public services that work. That is what we should be aiming for, and it is our decision to make. But it means we've got to chase economic growth, because without the resources produced by economic growth, we will not be able to achieve all of these desirable ends. So we've got to really focus on economic growth.
So come on, guys, just get the obstacles out the way. You've got the smart guy telling you how things are going to work. It really isn't rocket science. It's jobs, jobs, jobs that South Africa needs. And we're getting role models around the world who are doing it the right way. Talking to you from London, from the ARC conference, John Endres, who's the chief executive of the IRR, and I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.